Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Hi there, everyone. It's 4 o'clock in New York. The last best chance to hold the twice impeached and twice acquitted ex-president accountable is upon us. The Select Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection is expected to send a criminal contempt referral for former top Trump aide Steve Bannon to the full House floor. The front page of this morning's Washington Post captures this moment in which the January 6th committee is clearly flexing its muscle. And members of that committee, both Republican and Democratic, were out in force last night, sending a clear signal to the former president that this extraordinary action by the committee to ensure that no one is above the law is just the beginning. Here was committee chairman Betty Thompson last night on what is coming next for Bannon after the House vote and beyond.
We hope that the attorney general sees the importance of moving ahead with this indictment, moving ahead with locking Steve Bannon up, moving ahead with clearing the air that you can't conduct an insurrection on the government of the United States of America and nothing happened. So clearly, it will be in the Department of Justice's hand. Our committee on Tuesday evening, we will do our job, but this is just the beginning. I assure you, there are others, if they do not cooperate, they'll suffer the same fate.
In a news that should be deeply concerning for Donald Trump, a member of his own party last night, Adam Kinzinger, not ruling out a subpoena for the former president himself or for former Vice President Mike Pence. Watch.
Your colleague, Chairman Benny Thompson, has not ruled out a subpoena for former President Trump, saying tonight, quote, nobody is off limits to a subpoena from this committee. I mean, is that really realistic, potentially a subpoena for him or for even for Vice President Pence?
Yeah, I'm sure it's, you know, it is realistic. I mean, we're not going to jump to doing that immediately because obviously that's big. There's a lot of people that know a lot. But I'm going to tell you, I know the members of this committee. We've been meeting a lot. We're talking about these issues. We are determined to get to the bottom of what happened.
And yet, the ex-president squarely in the crosshairs of a very serious bipartisan congressional investigative committee that is intense in its focus, swift in its pace, and completely united in its mission, as you heard right there, to get to the bottom of Donald Trump's role in inciting the insurrection. There are more new signs today that the Republican Party is increasingly acquiescing to Donald Trump's control, even staking its entire future on continued, renewed loyalty to him. Washington Post reports this, quote, with more than a year to go before the midterms, the former president is leaving no corner of the party untouched as he moves to assert his dominance, both in public and behind the scenes. He stepped up efforts to create a conundrum for many of the party's strategists and lawmakers who believe they could have a banner election year in 2022 if they keep the focus on President Biden and his agenda. Take, for example, Donald Trump wrenching his party into uncharted territory this week when he released a statement urging his supporters not to vote if candidates didn't embrace his bogus claims of fraud. As we said yesterday, if that means that his supporters do not vote, so be it. But the chilling consequences of Trump's threat are already playing out, according to the Washington Post. Quote, already many GOP candidates are following Trump's lead, echoing false allegations that the election results were manipulated and raising the prospect that fraud will taint other elections. We should be clear about why we're stopping to discuss Twitterless, twice impeached Donald Trump and his bloviations and dangerous false allegations about voter fraud on the campaign trail. It's because they're part of a crime in progress. And it's essential that we identify the danger so it can be stopped. So argues Susan Glasser in her column this week in The New Yorker, which stresses that the era of Donald Trump cannot yet be relegated to memoirs and history books. Quote, the bottom line is that the story of the Trump presidency still has important unanswered questions that the forthcoming pile of books cannot answer, and they have an urgency about them, that unanswered questions about past administrations usually don't. given the ongoing threat to our democracy. Trump is not only preparing to run again, but is determined to mold the GOP into a single-issue party, the ideology of which consists solely of disputing the legitimacy of the election that turned him out of office. The Trump presidency is not yet, alas, simply a matter for booksellers and book writers. It is an active crime scene. And that active crime scene is where we start today with some of our favorite reporters and friends. Congressman Eric Swalwell of California is here. He's a member of the House Intelligence, Judiciary, and Homeland Security Committees. Also joining us, Betsy Woodruff Swan, national correspondent for Politico and an MSNBC contributor. And Robert Costa is here, Washington Post national political reporter and co-author of the new book, Peril. Bob Costa, I'm excited to talk to you about Susan Glasser's comments there about books, because you certainly unearthed part of that ongoing crime scene, and it lived on in congressional testimony not so many days ago. But I do want to start with some breaking news up on Capitol Hill with you, Congressman Swalwell. A 25-year veteran of the U.S. Capitol Police Force was charged today with trying to protect a man who was later accused of illegally entering the Capitol during the January 6th riot. A grand jury indictment charged Officer Michael Angelo Riley with repeatedly telling the man to delete all social media that would provide proof of him entering the building that day. Quote, "I'm a Capitol Police officer who agrees with your political stance," Riley said to him in a Facebook DM, according to the indictment. "Take down the part about being in the building. They are correctly investigating, and everyone who is in the building is going to be charged. Just looking out." Your reaction?
Who was he looking out for, Nicole? Was he looking out for the safety of the 150 officers who lost an eye, lost fingers, still have not yet come back to work? Was he looking out for our democracy? Because for 5 hours, it was suspended. And for the first time ever, we did not see a peaceful transition of power. No, he was looking out for Donald Trump. He was looking out for a radical Republican Party that is so dangerous to our country. They don't believe in majority rule anymore. He was looking out for himself. And, you know, the real shame here is he does not represent not even one iota of who the Capitol Police are. He is an isolated incident, whereas 99% of them fought in hand-to-hand combat that day. They are heroes to me, and just as much as they are heroes, I see him as the opposite of that. And I just don't want his performance that day or lack of performance to take anything away from the heroes who protected the Capitol.
Well, and I think to your point, I think the heroes have become household names. Officers Dunn, Officers Fanone, Officer Gunnell. They testified before the 1-6 committee. They were the first public witnesses. And it's an important point. But I do want to focus on this one case, because I wonder if you know if he was on duty ahead of his indictment. I mean, was he only dealt with in the indictment and then removed, or had he been on duty as a Capitol Police officer until he was indicted?
That's an important question, and that's why the January 6th Commission is, you know, so critical in getting to the bottom of this. Was he working on January 6th? You know, what did he do, if anything, to assist any of the insurrectionists that day? And then second, how long did he remain employed? Now, Nicole, we know that the FBI and any police agency wants to keep that type of information as a close hold as they're conducting an investigation. But now that he has been indicted, those are questions that must be answered.
And I wonder, just my last question on this topic, and then we'll move on to other news of the day. But Congressman, do you have concerns that there are other radicalized officers serving on the Capitol Police Force?
I am not concerned about that, Nicole, again, because I know the overwhelming majority of them are heroes and put their bodies in front of ours. And one of the worst things that I've seen across the country, though, is that people like Kevin McCarthy and Republican leaders have demeaned their service. And so I'm afraid that when you have on the right McCarthy demeaning their service, and now perhaps some on the left could say, well, you know, this is evidence of this officer's bad acts, that they're all bad, that the real heroes could lose their due. But I'm not concerned about that, Nicole. I think we owe it to our country to do a full vetting of everyone to make sure they're not radicalized. But I'll back, all of those cops that had our backs that day.
And as we were discussing, Betsy Woodruff Swan, the officers who first, I think, became household names were the first four witnesses before the 1-6 committee. The 1-6 committee, that feels like another era, right, of this committee's public phase. They're now moving into a very contentious, potentially public legal battle. And I wonder if you could take us through the steps that will have to take place to hold Steve Bannon in criminal contempt of Congress.
Tuesday is perhaps the most dramatic day yet for the January 6th Select Committee since that important hearing, because that day the committee is going to vote on whether or not to move forward with holding Bannon in contempt. Before they take that vote, they will issue a report. I believe this report will be public, and the report's going to lay out the case against Bannon, what the committee wants from him, the steps they took to try to get him to cooperate voluntarily, his defiance of their requests and demands for information, and finally, language for a House resolution that the committee will vote on holding Bannon in contempt. After it passes out of the committee, it will go to the floor of the House of Representatives. We don't know when, but we do know Speaker Pelosi is very much on board with the mission of the Select Committee, so we expect her to move quickly. It'll go to the floor of the House of Representatives. We expect it to pass the House, because Democrats, though it's just a narrow majority, do control the House. Then it will go over to the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of Washington, D.C. The person in charge of that office, Channing Phillips, is a long-serving career U.S. DOJ official who also signed off on the indictment of the police officer who you just spoke about. He's very much steeped in these issues of holding the people connected to January 6th accountable. And he's the one who's going to decide whether or not the Justice Department brings charges against Bannon for defying this subpoena. Of course, I expect he'll make that decision in consultation with senior political leaders at the Justice Department. I imagine Attorney General Garland will be involved in this decision since it's so high profile and sensitive. This is not the kind of thing that I expect the U.S. attorney to make unilaterally, but ultimately it's up to him. It's his call, and it's going to be a career DOJ official who makes this choice. That's the big question, what the Justice Department decides to do with Steve Bannon. I think if we had to bet, there's going to be a strong case against him, but it's a big dramatic step, and there's some suspense there.
Robert Kossoff, if there's no suspense, we're all out of business. But the suspense isn't around this question. It will likely be a bipartisan vote. I mean, Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger have been talking subpoenas as long as any Democratic member on that committee. And Adam Kinzinger going so far last night as to tell Anderson Cooper that you could certainly imagine this investigation as it works its way up, including subpoenas for former Vice President Mike Pence, former President Donald Trump. Talk about the committee's vision for the thoroughness and for sort of steaming through all of the steps that Betsy just laid out.
Our reporting shows why Bannon matters. At first, when we began this reporting project, he seems like a fringe player on the outside. But after 9 or 10 months, it's evident he's not a fringe player in the final days of the Trump presidency. He's talking daily to Rudy Giuliani. He's talking to President Trump. And so much of the January 6th story is not only about the day itself, but the days prior. Bannon was involved at the Willard Hotel on January 5th, working with Giuliani as across the street in the Oval Office, Trump was working Pence. They were all working state lawmakers, putting pressure on them, state officials, the Department of Justice. This was a coordinated campaign. And Bannon's in the middle of this as an ally of Trump, also having a podcast that's reaching out to conservative grassroots people across the country. He's at the nexus of power in this moment. That's why the committee cited the scenes from peril and why the story matters now about what Bannon does. He's not just an advisor. He's someone who's at the nexus of this story.
Congressman, he wasn't working him over for a vote on infrastructure. God knows they never got to Infrastructure Week in 4 years. Just working him over in their coup plot. It was a plot to overturn the will of the voters. John Eastman wrote the white paper, the sort of intellectual underpinning of the plan. They were working over, as Bob Costa has reported and just stated, Mike Pence to carry out what they envisioned, what was in that white paper. His role was to delay. They were Mr. Clark at DOJ, some underling several steps removed from the top official, was writing fraudulent letters to the state of Georgia to overturn their votes. Talk about Susan Glasser's description of this as an ongoing crime scene.
That's right, Nicole. And if, it's a case that is not yet closed because actually most of the suspects remain at large, and the same circumstances that led to January 6th still exist. You have Donald Trump, who is telling Republican voters that unless they resolve the fraudulent election, that they should not vote. He's still riling them up. He's got enablers now in Kevin McCarthy and others, and he's got outside amplifiers in Steve Bannon. And so this is a party that no longer believes in voting. They believe in violence. And that's why also right now it's so important for Democrats. Let's deliver on this Build Back Better agenda so that while Donald Trump and Kevin McCarthy and Steve Bannon circle the Capitol with gas cans in their hands and start dousing the place, getting ready to light that match, that we can get back to telling the voters what's at stake this upcoming election, that it would be so dangerous to turn the keys over to the Republicans. And so she's absolutely right. This commission will tell the voters who they are, what they wanted to do, and why they cannot be trusted to ever govern under this leadership structure again.
Betsy, this crime scene description, I think, carries through to this mob-like text that was sent to Trump supporters. Let me read it to you. It's from the NRCC. "You're a traitor. You abandoned Trump. We were told you were a tried and true lifelong patriot. But when Trump said he'd run for president if we took back the House from Nancy Pelosi, you did nothing. Was Trump wrong about you? Da, da, da. This is your final chance to prove your loyalty or be branded a deserter. We're giving you one final chance to stand with Trump. It would be funny if Trump hadn't actually sent people to the Capitol and people hadn't lost their lives, if police officers' bodies hadn't been mutilated with Trump flag poles. But it's not funny because that's the grip he has on his supporters. On what freaking planet does that get approved and sent out from a campaign committee?"
It's crazy to hear that. There's all sorts of wacky, over-the-top language that you see in emails that, you know, different campaign fundraising committees send out. But I've never seen a fundraising email that uses this type of militant language to suggest that people need to go to war with a former president, to suggest that if they don't participate, they're deserters, a military term. To suggest they could be traitors, obviously an incredibly loaded term to use, particularly regarding people who don't have any connection to government, many of whom are elderly, many of whom may not understand the actual subtext of these emails. Email fundraising messages often capitalize on reaching out to people who have trouble understanding exactly the complexities of politics, which is perhaps the least troubling thing about this extraordinarily over-the-top language. And the reality is that it matches what is actually going on within the Republican Party, particularly Trump's leadership in terms of trying to corral people using extraordinary tactics into getting on board with amplifying this lie.
You know, Robert Costa, my colleague Rachel Maddow said at the beginning of the Trump era, you know, watch what they do, not what they say. And what Mitch McConnell and Kevin McCarthy have done, as Donald Trump has gone about, in Liz Cheney's words, undermining the very foundation of our democracy, the integrity of our elections, Republicans have done nothing. Is that the plan?
You see right now a decision among many Republicans in high-ranking positions to not publicly fight Trump. And as a reporter, it's not for me to judge history. Voters will judge that decision. Many Republicans privately despise him, but publicly do not speak out. In politics, actions matter so often more than private words. And as we tried to do over 9 or 10 months is talk to people and figure out, why do you not do anything? Why did you not speak up? And some people even got emotional during some of these interviews about why they didn't speak up. And it ultimately came down to fear. Powerlessness in confronting fear. They fear Trump, his political capital. They fear his supporters. They fear they have no control over the party they affiliate with. This is a pervasive feeling within the Republican Party, and it raises serious questions, not just about the Republican future, but about democracy's future. If we have a system in which people are not playing by the same rules, abiding by the same norms, and they feel like they cannot contest someone who has shredded them to the extreme.
I mean, Congressman Swallow, it would be sad if it wasn't pathetic These are people who serve the country. Their salaries aren't paid by PACs or donors. They're paid by every single taxpayer. And they're too afraid to call out a lying bully who endangers our democracy. They're not fit to serve. And I guess my question for you is, how do you, as a Democratic Party, widen the tent for everyone that is for continuing to live in a democracy?
Right now, with democracy and life support, with the environment that Robert Costa just described, there are really only two camps. You are either in the camp that wants to resurrect and redeem this democracy, so that includes Liz Cheney, Adam Kinzinger, as far as I'm concerned, or you're in the camp that wants to pull the plug and take us toward an authoritarian state. And so I welcome Liz Cheney, and give me the problem that in a couple years, this democracy is still around and she and I can debate some of the issues we don't agree on. But if the other side that wants to pull the plug is successful, free speech, freedom of press, freedom of markets, that's all gone. And so we have to be a big tent party right now. And I'll just say this. I used to believe what Robert Costa said, and I think fear is a factor. But Adam Kinzinger is afraid. He gets threats all the time. So is Liz Cheney. That doesn't mean it gets in the way of them doing the right thing. I'm actually starting to think that for many of these people, they were never as honorable as they put out in the first place. They just now are showing their true colors because Donald Trump has created a permissive environment that makes it okay.
And Nicole, I would just add real quickly.
Please.
It's based on my reporting, the congressman makes a smart point. It's not just fear. I would add, sometimes they explain it away as fear. But let us not forget, at the end of the day, it is a decision they make. It is a choice, not just a reaction to Trump.
It's a decision they made when the tape came out that he grabbed women between the legs. It's a decision they make every time he talks about bleep hole countries. It's a decision they made when he talked about good people on both sides of a KKK rally. It's a decision they made when Secretary Mattis resigned in disgust with Donald Trump's disdain for our allies. It's a decision they made every single day. And the fact that they continue to make it now that he can't even send out a freaking tweet is pathetic. Congressman Eric Swalwell, Betsy Woodruff Swann, Robert Costa, thank you so much for starting us off on a Friday. When we come back, 2022 statehouse races are more important than ever for all the reasons we've been discussing as Republican-led legislatures work to enact sweeping new voting restrictions and election laws. It'll be up to governors to try to put a stop to this anti-democratic wave. Pennsylvania's Josh Shapiro hopes to have that job next year. He will be our next guest to talk about his plan and his race to preserve democracy in Pennsylvania. Plus, breaking today, the Biden administration will go back to the United States Supreme Court to try and pause the Texas abortion ban while its fate plays out through the courts. Gaming out what the court might do with women's reproductive freedoms on the line in the entire country. We'll have that reporting. And later in the show, the latest fight out of Texas, culture wars on education, requiring an opposing view of the Holocaust. Yes, this is real, not The Onion. All those stories and more when Deadline White House continues after a quick break. Don't go anywhere.
Get the latest updates on this year's high-stakes election with MSNBC's How to Win 2024 newsletter. When you subscribe, you'll get expert analysis on key races sent straight to your inbox, including articles written by the host of the How to Win podcast, Jennifer Palmieri. Subscribe today at MSNBC.com/win.
Hi, everyone. It's Katie Fang. Did you know my weekly show on MSNBC is now available as a podcast? With my decades of experience as a trial lawyer, you'll get an insider's perspective on all things legal. At a time when politics and the law are inextricably intertwined, my guests and I break down what's next and why it matters, both inside and outside the courtroom. Search for The Katie Fang Show wherever you're listening and follow.
We're at a critical time in America, here in Pennsylvania, too. Already, there are Republicans running for governor who want to lead us down a dark path, undermine free and fair elections, strip away voting rights, and permanently divide us. That's the kind of divisive politics that gets in the way of solving real problems.
That was Pennsylvania's Attorney General Josh Shapiro announcing his run for governor. Shapiro there staking his entire candidacy on voting rights and the state of our democracy, and for good reason. Pennsylvania isn't just one of the few really, really important battleground states that's likely to determine the outcome of the next presidential election. It is also where Republicans are trying to get the personal data of all 9 million voters there as part of a partisan audit of the election that's meant to breathe new life into Donald Trump's lies about election fraud. And we're the only thing standing in the way of voter suppression bills there passed by the GOP-led legislature in Pennsylvania is the veto pen of a term-limited Democratic governor. The stakes could not be higher. Joining us now, Pennsylvania's Josh Shapiro. I think this is the first time I have talked to you and you haven't been in your home, maybe Zooming with some of your family members behind you. Tell me what this campaign will be about specifically.
Well, you're catching me, Nicole, here in northeastern Pennsylvania. Actually, just finished a rally in Pittston with Senator Bob Casey. And we were talking about the future of our democracy. We were talking about what's at stake. And I was stressing the importance of protecting voting rights, protecting our democracy, so that we can meet this moment of real challenge in Pennsylvania and do the things we need to do to help folks, like invest in infrastructure and grow our economy and make sure everybody has access to good health care and a quality school. At the foundation of all of this is making sure we've got a strong democracy to stand on. And based on the people I've been talking to all across the Commonwealth, they recognize the stakes are really high.
I want to ask you a question sort of as a former campaign strategist. And obviously, presidential elections are a bunch of different statewide efforts. And I wonder, you know, the inverse is also true. A statewide election can be about a national referendum. And I wonder if your strategy coming into this is around this national conversation of elections like yours mattering in terms of the future of the democracy. And if you're seeing that really hit people in the gut in Pennsylvania, or is it still more about local, more tactical issues?
Well, I actually think it can be about local issues, and people here on the ground can also care about our democracy. I mean, I'm taking my cues from the people in Washington County, not Washington, D.C. But the folks in Washington County, Pennsylvania, they know that our democracy is at risk. They sense that this moment that we're in is very, very serious, and that we've got to rise to meet the challenge, and that each of us has a responsibility to do our part to get off the sidelines and get in the game and protect this 245-year experiment that began right here in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
Is your campaign cognizant of the dangers of disinformation? I mean, the national conversation is so polluted by Fox News and Facebook and right-wing disinformation. But I wonder if you feel like by being on the ground, by being able to reach out and talk face to face with your voters, if you can get around that.
The disinformation is real. And by the way, as Attorney General, I've been working very hard to hold the platforms that are pushing that disinformation and the players doing it certainly accountable. But I will tell you that disinformation, you don't have to hunt through the algorithms on Facebook to find it. Just go look at the leaders of the modern day Republican Party today in Pennsylvania. They're the ones peddling the big lie. They're the ones pandering out of weakness and trying to pass these far right litmus tests. And the good people of Pennsylvania have been lied to for nearly a year by the leaders of the Republican Party here. And so it's on me not just to, you know, focus on, you know, the algorithms that are sharing that misinformation, but also take the fight directly to the leaders of the modern day Republican Party here in Pennsylvania and speak truth in the face of their lies. Look, there is a price to their lies, Nicole. We've talked about this. It's not just the erosion of our democracy, but it's also the missed opportunities to meet this moment of challenge in Pennsylvania. And so while I'm focused on meeting that moment, connecting people to the internet, giving them good schools and access to healthcare, they're focused, the other side is on the big lie.
Well, and it seems like a person on the side of democracy, which happens to be members of the Democratic Party at this hour for our country, have to do both. I mean, you have to talk about delivering, you have to combat the big lie. I want to give you a chance to do that. I don't know if you'd describe him as a leader of the Republican Party there, but this is Lou Barletta on a radio show back in June spouting conspiracies. And I wonder if you think this is what the other side will be talking about.
Could you possibly win if we continue to allow, you know, what's going on? No voter ID, no signature matching, you know, chain of custody gone. You know, because people, dead people, we know this, have been voting in Pennsylvania for a long time. Dead people have been voting. We know that. Now they don't even have to leave the cemetery. They can mail in their ballots right from the cemetery. I mean, this has got to stop.
I believe most of the dead people who the multiple audits have turned up actually voted from the cemetery for Donald Trump. But if you want to fact check any more of that, have at it.
That's a great example of what I'm talking about. One of the leaders of the modern day Republican Party lying to the people that he wants to serve. Literally lying. Look, I'm the chief law enforcement officer of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. There were a handful of these type of fraud cases in Pennsylvania in the last election. And within that handful, each of the people who were caught and prosecuted were trying to cast one extra vote for Donald Trump. What the former representative said there is just a blatant lie. And it goes back to what I said before. They are pandering out of a position of weakness. And every day they lie to the good people of Pennsylvania is another day they're not working to solve problems. I'm working together with Democrats, Republicans, Independents to solve problems and help people here in the Commonwealth. And what they're doing is the exact opposite. And that is the stark choice in this election. Understand that if folks like that win this election, they appoint secretaries of state who are beholden not to the people of Pennsylvania, but beholden to the former president. They appoint secretaries of state who also go and spread those conspiracy theories and undermine our elections. That's why I say democracy is on the ballot. And that's why I say the progress we need to make on so many other issues from energy to education rest on making sure we have a strong democracy where everybody's voice is heard, every vote counts, and that we can move forward as a Commonwealth in speaking truth.
I want to ask you about something pertaining to your current job, your day job. This is from a motion you filed yesterday to strike down the subpoena for all of the personal information of every voter in the Commonwealth, I believe. So part of their social security numbers, phone numbers. You wrote this in the filing. The subpoena is inseparable from the effort by former President Trump and his supporters, including Senators Cormann and Dush, to promote distrust in the 2020 presidential election. Senators Dush and Cormann have been unshakable in their commitment to that bad faith objective, and this investigation is yet another step to appease the former president. Since launching this new phase of the investigation, Senators Dush and Cormann have said explicitly that the former president is comfortable with the investigation and is watching closely. Are they oblivious to, indifferent to, defiant of all of the court cases that made their way through Pennsylvania? All of Rudy Giuliani's earliest and most humiliating failures, I believe, were in the Commonwealth. What are they talking about?
Well, who knows what they're talking about? Because here's the truth. We had a safe and secure, free and fair election here in Pennsylvania that Joe Biden won by over 80,000 votes, that Nicole was audited twice as legally required. And now, because they're pandering out of a position of weakness, because they're so willing to lie to the people of Pennsylvania for their own political needs, they are seeking the private personal information, social security numbers, driver's license numbers, addresses, all that kind of stuff, of 9 million Pennsylvania voters. So we've gone to court to stop them from getting this information. The information they're seeking would violate our laws and undermine people's constitutional right to privacy. We believe it would have a chilling effect on voting and our elections, and that's why I've gone to court to stop them. We simply can't allow them, in the name of this pandering, to compromise the personal information of Pennsylvanians. So that's why I'm in court. And Nicole, as you know, every time I've gone to court when it comes to this election, we've won, they've lost, and our democracy has been protected.
Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro, with our focus on the sort of statewide efforts and the role that statewide leaders have to protect our democracy, we'll stay on this. Thank you for spending some time with us. It has been 6 weeks now that women in Texas have been living under the nation's most extreme ban on abortions. 85% of all abortions there are banned in that new law. The law heads back now to the United States Supreme Court. Will there be any surprises as to what the court will do? Our panel joins us next. Breaking news today, the Justice Department saying they will again ask the United States Supreme Court to prevent Texas's near total ban on abortions from taking effect while the case moves through the courts. The move comes after the conservative Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled last night against DOJ's request to reinstate a lower court's injunction on the near complete ban. The order was decided 2-1, backed by two conservative judges, James Ho, a Trump appointee, and Katharina Haynes, a nominee of George W. Bush's. The United States Supreme Court has already declined to block this very same Texas law from going into effect once, condemning Texas women to a hellish reality via an unsigned order in the middle of the night, the shadow docket. Joining our coverage, MSNBC legal analyst and civil rights professor Maya Wiley. Brian Fallon's here, executive director of the progressive court group Demand Justice. And the Rev. Al Sharpton's here, host of MSNBC's Politics Nation and president of the National Action Network. Maya Wiley, your thoughts about whether DOJ will be successful?
Well, hard to predict what this particular Supreme Court will do. I will say that the Department of Justice should be successful, because remember, the Department of Justice's case is a very different one from the case that the Supreme Court said, we're not going to touch that. We're going to allow that law to stay in place until we hear the actual case on Roe v. Wade, on whether what it has done in Texas is constitutional. But what the Department of Justice did is say, wait, we're the ones coming in to say it absolutely violates Roe v. Wade. It is unconstitutional. And in fact, it prevents us as the federal government from being able to protect women who are in our custody from being able to get their constitutional right to an abortion seen to in the state of Texas. So that means that it's right there before the Supreme Court. It is a stronger case as a result, because the other case was a little bit more. I still think Justice Roberts was right when he said we should let this preliminary injunction stand. But the reality is it was providers suing judges. This is a very, very different case. It's a strong one. The Department of Justice makes it clear what's at stake, and it's the constitutional rights of people seeking an abortion.
We have sought to never let our legal analysis stray too far from the reality for women in Texas. 85% of all abortions in Texas take place after this 6-week mark. Most women are actually only about 4 weeks pregnant by that point. I'm going to read from the Dallas Morning News about what's happening in Texas right now. We should all know. In just one recent month, 7 pregnant 12-year-olds and their caregivers sought help at the Dallas Children's Advocacy Center, which handles the most serious criminal sex abuse cases in the county, where victims first share the atrocities in which they have been trapped. Staff members told of recent pregnant rape victims as young as 9 years old. The Advocacy Center staff shared stories of 12-year-olds trying to find maternity clothes, of girls who must continue attending their neighborhood school as their pregnancy progresses, of bewildered children who believe their own bodies have become alien beings. Maya Wiley, how is this happening in the United States of America in 2021?
Fundamentally, it's happening because, number one, we had a Congress that did not allow our constitutional norms around how we select Supreme Court justices. But number two, that we have become, you know, I'm afraid we have become so distant from the actual experiences of people, particularly low-income women, because about half of women who seek abortions are low-income, who struggle to get them. About 70% of them almost are already mothers, and they're making decisions about the lives of themselves and their families. But to even go so far as to say that we will be so ideological that we will say that a woman or child does not have the power to make a decision for themselves, even when raped, is just so far beyond the pale. But it is because we have gotten so far from any real discussion about what our lives is like, who we are, and what it really means to take care of each other and to support people, to support themselves and their families, and to make rational decisions over their lives. And it is an extremely harmful reality for our democracy and just the lives of our people in this country. And it affects all of us, but particularly poor women. And we have to call it out in that story.
I mean, Brian Fallon, part of why we're here is because to Mitch McConnell, it's not about women. It's not about people. It's a game. I mean, Supreme Court judges in general have been Mitch McConnell's game for a long time.
Absolutely. And the conservative supermajority that now sits on the Supreme Court is the intentional outcome of a 40-year project that has happened on the political right. And now they intend to make good on it by advancing state laws like the one in Texas. And so I'm not surprised that Republicans are pursuing these goals, as horrendous as the outcomes are, as you just read. I think that the challenge that we face is one that Democrats must confront. You know, some of the scenes that you just read out before your question to Maya are ones that abortion rights advocates warned were going to be the outcome if Democrats did not do everything they could to try to stop Brett Kavanaugh, to try to stop Amy Coney Barrett. And for the last several years, Democrats have sort of been asleep at the wheel when it comes to addressing the courts. And Maya is absolutely right, as she always is, that the Justice Department should prevail on the merits before the Supreme Court in its latest challenge to the Texas law. But I don't think any of us have any confidence that that will be the case, because we know that this Supreme Court is very outcome-oriented. And even though novel arguments are being presented this time by the Justice Department, the conservatives like Alito and Thomas may very well find new arguments to let the law stand. And so Democrats can't put all the eggs in the basket of this litigation. Why aren't we seeing the Biden administration call for an end to the filibuster to pass the Women's Health Protection Act to codify Roe? We need to see all steps taken to preserve abortion rights. Otherwise, we're going to continue to see laws like the Texas one.
Rev, I'm not a Democratic strategist. I worked on the other side. I regret it most of the days these days. But I am part of the Democratic Voting Coalition, and I cannot for the life of me figure out why an issue, I mean, 85% of all abortions are banned. 100% of abortions for victims of rape and incest are essentially banned with this law. That is a position that is unpopular among pro-life Republican voters. I would lead with this story every day if Democrats would hold hearings. Why is it just a matter of bandwidth? Why isn't this a bigger deal?
The reason it's not a bigger deal is I think that the Democrats are really missing the point of how much this needs to be their lead in terms of bringing it to the public, because there would be overwhelming support for the Democrats on this. And I think it would push the Supreme Court, who acts oblivious to public opinion, but clearly they understand the public. They would have to listen and weigh what is going on here, because what will happen is that if the Supreme Court uses this to erode Roe versus Wade, or in any way act as though there is a legitimate reason to put women through the misery that we've heard in some of the statements that you read on tonight on the show, and that I've read on other occasions, it will put front and center the argument to need to either reform the Supreme Court or expand the Supreme Court. So the Supreme Court needs to understand that they may be voting against poor women and women of color, but they may be investing in a movement that will change the Supreme Court. I agree with Brian. This is the end of a four-year plan, or the result of a four-year plan that never stopped marching to get us to this point. But I think what they did not plan is inciting a movement that will change the court. And I think that if the court operates in this insensitivity, they will give the impetus for a real movement to reform the Supreme Court. So my point is to look at the right wingers on the court in the eye and say, be my guest.
Yeah, knock yourself out. We're going to tackle that on the other side of a quick break. Court reform is next.
When news breaks, go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app.
New developments in the legal drama surrounding former President Donald Trump.
Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows and hosts.
Lots of news of all kinds going on right now.
And the latest updates on the 2024 election.
The rematch is on. It's Trump-Biden Part 2.
Go beyond the what to understand the why. Download the app now at msnbc.com/app.
Hey, everyone, it's Chris Hayes. This week on my podcast, Why Is This Happening? We're back with another installment of our special series with Pod 2024, The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about both Joe Biden and Donald Trump's records on specific policy areas during their time as president. This week, economist Kim Clausing on taxes.
Underfunding the IRS really serves the interest of dishonest people at the top rather than your typical worker who would benefit from being able to get their questions answered and getting their returns processed in a quick way.
That's this week on Why Is This Happening? Search for Why Is This Happening wherever you're listening right now and follow.
Members of the legal commission President Biden tapped to consider proposed reforms to the United States Supreme Court are divided on perhaps the biggest measure, and that's court expansion. Many congressional Democrats and progressive groups have recommended adding judges as a move to balance what is clearly a very partisan court. Part of the panel warned that expansion is, quote, likely to undermine the Supreme Court's legitimacy and role, and that there are, quote, significant reasons to be skeptical that expansion would serve Democratic values. But as New York Times notes today, the commission took a different tone with proposed term limits for judges who currently serve life terms, saying it, quote, appears to enjoy the most widespread and bipartisan support among the proposals. We're back with Maya, Brian, and the Rev. Brian Fallon, I saw you react quickly and decisively. I'll let you do so here.
Well, the Biden commission, we have to understand, was set up to really stall and provide time for President Biden, who is not really keen on any of these structural reform proposals, to fight other issues, to prioritize other parts of his agenda. And so when he announced this in October of last year, it was really an attempt to sort of put this conversation at arm's length. And in the way that they built the commission with the people that they invited to serve on it, it doubled down on the idea that this was a commission that was dead set against proposing anything bold or game changing. They drew from the ranks of scholars that serve at prestigious law schools, practitioners that appear before the court routinely and are going to be loath to propose any big radical changes to it. And then they even put a lot of conservatives on who, you know, by their own writings, admitted that they didn't want to see any changes made to the court. So this, the process was rather rigged from the beginning. And so this, the report's outcome in the draft version that leaked yesterday, it was produced yesterday, it was really not a surprise. But then the most surprising or interesting thing that happened today, Nicole, was that in the first discussion opportunity where members of the commission actually got to react to the discussion draft that came out yesterday, you heard a number of commissioners say, this report does not speak for me. I thought that it ruled out expansion too quickly. People like Sherrilyn Ifill, the head of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, Larry Tribe from Harvard, people said, I don't think I can support signing on to this report with so much bias that it shows towards ideas like expansion. So the fact that expansion now has supporters, even on this 36-person commission that Biden set up to try to keep expansion at arm's length, tells me that there's growing momentum behind this idea.
Rev, I'm not sure I add much to any of these conversations except telling you I know exactly what Republicans would do if they found themselves in a position with a 6-3 majority in the other direction. They would not be wringing their hands or wondering. They would be for expansion. Are Democrats getting to the point where they're ready to sort of fight some of these big issues like Republicans?
I think the base of the Democratic Party, I think the voters are there. I think that a lot of the leadership they're misreading their own voters, their own constituents. And sometimes when the leaders of a march don't move as fast as the marchers, they end up with the marchers overtaking the march and they'll become new leaders. And I think that's what's going to happen here, because it is unthinkable that if we were in the reverse situation of 6-3 far left, because we're talking about far right. We're not just talking about right or center. We're talking about far right. If we had a far left court, there'd be no question the Republicans would be beating the drums and having all kinds of public momentums that they would be establishing to reform the court and would get public opinion on their side. I think that the Democratic leadership needs to get out of the way of the Democratic people and let's democratize the Supreme Court. If nothing shows this, we've lost voting rights and now women's rights with this court. What else do we need to do? Start having the court vote that the earth is square and it's not round? I mean, what do they need to do?
It is interesting. You've got one address, Justice Alito, writing about voter fraud, which, as we all know from Bill Barr, in the thing. Maya Wiley, Brian Fallon, the Rev. Al Sharpton, thank you so much for spending some time with us today. The next hour of Deadline White House starts after a quick break. Don't go anywhere. We're just getting started.
Easily, a map could have been constructed that would have not done the following, that would have not put two members from the same political party of color in the same congressional district. I know what discrimination looks like. I know what it smells like. I know what it tastes like. I know what it sounds like, and I know what it hurts like. That map hurts.
Wow. Hi again, everyone. It's 5 o'clock in New York. The consequences of an unbridled, power-hungry GOP on full display there in the Lone Star State. That was Congressman Al Green before a Texas House committee on Wednesday calling out what he believes are the motivations behind the newly drawn district map in Texas. Washington Post reports this, quote, a new Texas congressional map shreds Democratic Representative Sheila Jackson Lee's Houston-based district, siphoning off thousands of her black constituents and forcing her into a potential primary against her neighboring black incumbent, Representative Al Green, who you heard there. Critics of the new plan say it's racial gerrymandering intended to weaken black voices in Congress. Washington Post spoke with Jackson Lee, who said no one has given her an explanation for why she was drawn out of her district. Quote, there was absolutely no response. This was purposeful racial gerrymandering, which is very shameful in 2021. I am stunned. We are hurt, but we're not giving up, she said. Not giving up the fight as Texas Republicans show more and more and more the danger they pose in power. Here's what we've seen so far. They're attempting to silence certain voters by enacting new voter suppression laws predicated on a lie. They're banning companies and schools, being able to enforce COVID vaccine mandates and other public health measures. And they're essentially outlawing all but a very, very, very few abortions in the state. That new abortion law heading back to the U.S. Supreme Court, as today DOJ announced it will ask the highest court to block it following an appeals court ruling yesterday that keeps the law in place. There are also new developments out of a Texas school district that bring the state's culture wars to dizzying new heights or lows. Quick backstory. One of the laws Texas passed earlier this year was House Bill 3979. It requires teachers to present multiple perspectives when discussing widely debated and currently controversial issues. In other words, it was the Republicans' way to abolish critical race theory in Texas. Recently, the Carroll Independent School District in Southlake, Texas, had special training after the district school board, in response to a parent's complaint, voted to reprimand a fourth grade teacher who had kept an anti-racism book in her classroom. NBC News obtained an audio recording of that training. Take a listen to what is an unbelievable conversation in the United States of America in 2021. The woman you hear, Gina Petty, is the district's executive director of curriculum and instruction.
We are in the middle of a political mess, and you are in the middle of a political mess. And so we just have to do the best that we can. And so we're going to go and you're going to do what you do best, and that's to teach kids.
I think we're all just really terrified.
I think you are terrified. And I wish I could take that away. I do. I can't. I can't do that. You are professionals. We hired you as professionals. We trust you with our children. So if you think the book is okay, then let's go with it. And whatever happens, we will fight it together. We will.
As you go through, just try to remember the concepts of 3979 and make sure that if you have a book on the Holocaust, that you have one that has opposing, that has other books.
How do you oppose the Holocaust?
What? Believe me, that's come up.
So number the stars.
That's come up. Teaching the other side of the Holocaust, according to her, has come up in Texas. That is the state of Texas right now. Right now. Requiring an opposing view of the Holocaust because it's come up. It's where we begin this hour with some of our favorite reporters and friends. In a moment, we will be joined by Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee of Texas. She's a member of the House Judiciary and Homeland Security Committees. Also joining us, Charlie Sykes, editor-in-chief of The Bulwark and an MSNBC contributor, and Ari Berman, senior reporter for Mother Jones. Ari, you've done some great reporting on redistricting. I need to deal with the other side of the Holocaust. The right is sort of famous for making culture wars work. Do you think, Charlie, that the other side of the Holocaust is a bridge too far, or is this where we're heading?
Well, of course it's a bridge too far. You know, and it's easy to beat up on the administrator here, and she's going to get dragged for all of that. But I think that the focus ought to be on the law and the fact that the teachers are terrified. They don't know what's going to happen. You know, conservative legislators used to talk a lot about the unintended consequences of legislation. What are the unintended consequences of this heavy-handed legislation? That the teachers don't know what books they can assign. So here we have the party of small government in the business of banning ideas, of banning books, and then, of course, creating a situation where you go, hey, if you're dealing with anything controversial, no, you might get in trouble, including if you teach a book on the Holocaust. Look, I don't know what that means. What is the other side of the Holocaust? Are you going to assign fourth graders Mein Kampf? Are you going to make them listen to Seb Gorka's radio show? I just don't know what the what she actually had in mind. But again, this is exactly what you get when you have politicians playing culture war and then trying to ram that into badly thought out draconian legislation. And by the way, you know, I am actually old enough, Nicole, maybe you can help me with this. I mean, I know that Republicans in Texas have been conservative for a long time, but there was a time when conservative Republicans in Texas were not absolutely batshit crazy. And I think this is the question. At what point, I mean, Texas Republicans used to be kind of respectable. I mean, you had the Bushes, you had people like, you know, John Conley, who switched parties. You had, you know, a variety of folks. And now we are almost in this competition between, I don't know, is it a competition between Florida, Arizona, and Texas? Who can be the most MAGA? Who can play the most hair on fire culture war games? Because that seems to be this race to the bottom that we're talking about here.
I'll deal with batshit crazy in a minute. Let me just push back, though. The teachers are terrified because they're taking their cues from someone who told them to teach the other side of the Holocaust. And I understand that the law is the law, but I think it's crazy. And so I think when you have someone who's saying, on the one hand, we trust you with our kids, on the other hand, teach the other side of the Holocaust, there is no other side of the Holocaust. And I just want to make sure that we're clear that, of course, there's no other side of the Holocaust.
Yeah. No, there's no other side of the Holocaust. But I guess what I'm trying to say is that what do we accomplish by dragging this one administrator? I mean, this goes back to what Governor Greg Abbott did, what the Republicans in the legislature have done, creating this weird intellectual environment where teachers are genuinely terrified and where you have crazy talk like, well, you know, if you teach a book like the Holocaust, and by the way, this is completely indefensible. I don't know why she thought of that. You know, was the next sentence going to be, and if you teach a book, if you teach anything about slavery, you have to have the other side of that as well. Is that where we're going? Well, apparently that's where we're already at now in the state of Texas.
It is indeed. Ari, I want to get your thoughts on this story as well as your reporting on redistricting that we started with.
Well, Nicole, I feel like this is all connected because my big concern is that Texas is becoming like South Africa used to be, which is a place where people of color are the majority, but it's ruled by a reactionary white minority. And I happen to think all of these things are connected, that it's all about the preservation of white power. Because if you look at the gerrymandering that's happening right now, it's being done to dilute the voices of communities of color. If you look at the voter suppression that has been passed in Texas recently, it's being passed to dilute the voices of communities of color. If you look at the abortion restrictions that have been enacted, those are going to fall most heavily on communities of color. We don't think about abortion as a racial justice issue, but it is. If you look at how they're restricting teaching, what they're trying to do is deny the lived experiences of racial and ethnic minorities. So this is all connected here. And my fear is that Texas is a prototype of what Republicans want to do everywhere, which is to pass extreme and unpopular policies, then attack democracy through tactics like voter suppression and gerrymandering so they can override the will of the voters. years.
And I guess the most terrifying thing is the speed and the success that they're having at it. I'd like to bring into our conversation Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee. Congresswoman, we started the show with the news that and your quotes in The Washington Post about your district being carved up. I wonder if you've had any additional or better or new updates for us on the state of that.
Well, all I can say is that what we have found in the state of Texas is they've been given a bounty. They're now the largest state. When I say a bouquet of multicultural people, they are now the largest state in the union. And they were able to get two extra seats. And what did they do? Punish people of color. No, there is no update other than to say that the plan that destroyed the 18th congressional district and placed a burden on the 9th congressional district, put two African-American Democrats in the same district. We haven't seen that in 50 years since Barbara Jordan held this seat. After more than 100 people indicated they opposed it in a hearing that was called within minutes of the deadline, 24 hours, and people had to scramble to get on to be heard on a virtual call, if you will. And even after all of those no's, the bill or the plan was forced out of committee. No amendments were allowed. And so tomorrow, Nicole, and thank you for having me, is D-Day. Tomorrow is when this bill will come to the floor of the State House, and people of goodwill, legislators, will try to offer amendments that will fix a number of concerns that the people of this great state have. And you know what? We need to stop the divide in Texas. We need to stop the image and perception that we are not good people. The majority of us want a democratic republic. We want to be able to teach the Holocaust in its rightful way, the truth. We don't want to teach hate. And we want to protect our teachers. Just as a member of the Judiciary Committee, let me offer this. Teachers have First Amendment rights, and teachers should not be dominated by someone who is wrong. And if a teacher chooses to teach the Holocaust and teach it right, and someone wants them to teach hate, I want them to exercise their constitutional First Amendment rights and reject that admonition or that instruction. And we will stand by them. They will have a federal case. So we want people to know us in that light, that we teach the truth. We teach about slavery in the right way. We teach about Barbara Jordan being the first person to go to Congress in since Reconstruction. That's what we want them to know about us.
Congresswoman, I've never met a Texan, and I know a lot of people from Texas who didn't love Texas and Texans. But I want to read you something Charles Blow writes in The New York Times today. And ask you if this is starting, if Texas is starting to strain your love affair with the state. Texas is a leader in oppression. It is institutionalizing and legalizing racism, misogyny, and transphobia. The Lone Star State is hardly alone in its oppressive ambitions. Other states are watching and waiting, poised to follow its lead. As the Washington Post put it last month, quote, Texas created a blueprint for abortion restrictions with Republicans in at least seven other states planning to replicate the state's restrictions. We could look forward to some of those states mimicking Texas on voter restrictions as well. In this way, Texas is a harbinger of doom. It's the leading edge of regression. It provides a picture of where the Republican-controlled portion of the United States may be heading, down the tubes in a Stetson hat. Is Texas going down the tubes, Congresswoman?
Texas is a megaphone that needs to be, at least a megaphone that is present. And unfortunately, our state government is controlled by persons who are, as Charles has indicated, part of the doom of a past America. They're part of the doom of oppression. But I want you to know that there are people, loving people of so many diverse groups. There are young people. We are trying to break loose and lead Texas into the 21st century. We ask other states to stand up and help us to reject the despotic and cruel legislative initiatives of Texas. Don't pass this anti-abortion law, this cruel bounty bill that looks like slavery. Don't do that. And we are fighting inside. If we have to go to court on these redistricting to prove that these districts are protected districts under the existing voting rights, even though it's been challenged, that case law still exists. We have the right to exist as the 18th district, the 9th district, and the 30th district by court law, federal court law that has not been overturned. So don't give up, but yet don't follow the despots. Listen to voices that are out in the streets protesting with me, women, men, boys and girls, and of course, our people, our members of the community of color. And so That is the new Texas. We still exist, but we have been overcome by the loud voices and, of course, the wrong voices. Please view these as the wrong voices. And I might say, Nicole, my district is on the chopping block because I have not been silenced. I've not been silenced during the pandemic when we were slow to react, when our state continued to be a hotspot because our governor refused to have masks, did not want a mandate of vaccines, didn't want schools to do anything to help the children, and was slow to get vaccines out and other ways of helping the people of Texas. I'm sorry that is the case, but we're fighting every day. That is not the definition of the new Texas. We are here and we are shouting as loud as we can.
The Republicans in Texas, Congresswoman, passed voting restrictions in a state that is known among anyone who knows anything about elections and campaigns as the hardest state in the country already in which to vote. How urgent is the need for filibuster reform and for the United States Senate to pass federal voting rights legislation?
I'll be very quick on that. The urgency is yesterday. We are really suffering here. We're suffering because of the delay of Senator Sinema and Senator Manchin on Build Back and the Invest Act, which can do an enormous transformational change for the people of Texas. And we are suffering because of a procedural rule that is not embedded in the Constitution. It is not a statute. It is a Senate rule, just as you would have a House rule. It is easily rolled off for a temporary period of time to be able to save those of us who are trying to fight. That is my constituents. We need the filibuster gone, and we need it gone as soon as possible. And we also need to be able to ensure that we have a circumstance, if you will, that moves these bills along, moves the S1 along, and moves the John Robert Lewis voting rights. If this had been the law, this would not have happened to the poor voters of Texas.
Right.
Because pre-clearance have to have occurred before this dastardly, dangerous stripping of power, imploding of a historic district could have ever occurred. Isn't that sad? We had it all ready to go, and we could not move it to the president's desk. We have to do it right away now.
Congresswoman, have you made this case to Senator Sinema and Manchin face-to-face?
I have done so to Senator Manchin in conversations some months ago. You can be assured that I will be igniting it. And I hope, as my public voice is heard today on MSNBC, that Senator Sinema will listen to us. Very difficult trying to reach her, the colleague that I served with in the House. You have great respect for her. And I hope that she will take my call and my visit. We'll be back in Washington next week. But we are suffering. And here's what the real angst is. The angst is that we believe this is going to roll across the South and, frankly, roll across the process of redistricting. Texas did it early. And believe me, they left no time for any community hearings or input. And there were people who were in the majority community, if you will, white Texans who were appalled at this, how their communities were cut across simply to save GOP incumbents, which they didn't bother to respond to those of us who were not of their party. But the key is that we need to have the tools of federal law to stop this kind of siege across America. And it will occur. If they can't get you at the ballot box, if they can't silence your voice at the ballot box, then they will attempt to silence you by writing you out. That is not a democratic republic. It is not democracy. And I don't think we can allow that to stand, not as a state, but as a nation. So I will hope to talk to Senator Manchin, as I've done. I look forward to talking to Senator Sinema on a number of occasions dealing with the Build Back, the Invest, the Freedom to Vote, and, of course, the John Robert Lewis. We are behind in saving America. Texas can be saved if we save America.
Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee, thank you so much for spending some time with us. We'll stay in touch with you. Please come back. Charlie Sykes, I saw you.
Thank you for having
me. Thank you so much. Charlie Sykes, I saw you nodding as she was speaking.
Well, I think, look, this is one of the things that the Congress ought to act on, which is this whole notion of relying on gerrymandered districts to apportion the Congress. I am late to this particular issue, but I think that in terms of the abuses that we've seen across the country, this seems to be one of the minimum things. Look, you're not going to get H.R. 1. That's not going to happen. But, you know, if you are going to drill down on what is absolutely necessary, and you've heard me say this before, You know, the Congress needs to change the electoral vote count. They need to do something about gerrymandering. They need to make sure that state legislators cannot disenfranchise the popular vote. These are the bare minimum things. And if it takes abolishing or carving out the filibuster to do it, they need to do that.
Ari, you are not late, and I know some of your private views about folks like Charlie and I who are late to these issues. Tell me why this is hard for the Democratic Party to put aside filibuster reform and pass federal voting rights legislation that deals with all of these issues.
Well, I don't think there's been a sense of urgency from the Democrats about the voter suppression and the gerrymandering that we're seeing. There was a perception that if they just passed popular policies, that would be enough. They could out-organize these efforts. And we're seeing you can't out-organize surgical voter suppression, and you certainly can't out-organize extreme gerrymandering. You can't out-organizing the dismantling of majority-minority districts. You can't out-organize the fact that 95% of demographic changes in Texas were communities of color, were from communities of color, but the number of white districts increased and the number of Black and Latino districts decreased. That's not something you can out-organized here. And so I don't think this was a top priority of the Biden administration going forward. Democrats said it was a top priority, but they have not acted with the urgency to make it a top priority. And there's never been a plan for overcoming the filibuster. And maybe the filibuster can't be overcome because Manchin and Sinema can't be swayed. This is now next week, Nicole, going to be the third vote on voting rights legislation. They still don't have a plan to pass it. And that's just incredible when you look at all the voter suppression and gerrymandering that's gone on throughout the United States in the first 9 or 10 months of this year.
Yeah, it's like sitting around and deciding you need a neighborhood patrol as all the houses in the neighborhood are being ransacked. It's unbelievable. Ari Berman, Charlie Sykes, thank you so much for starting us off this hour. When we come back, among a long list of pettiness and cruelty from the twice impeached, disgraced ex-president, the firing and the obsession with Deputy FBI Director Andrew McCabe, just a day until his pension kicked in, stood out even for Trump. Today, Andrew McCabe is enjoying a little bit of redemption. We'll tell you all about it next. Plus, Secretary of Transportation Pete Buttigieg responds to criticism aimed at him for being a dad and taking some parental leave. He'll be our guest. And Democrats sending in their biggest, boldest superstars to campaign in Virginia for Terry McAuliffe, starting tonight with First Lady Dr. Jill Biden. Will the Democrats' star power be enough to win Virginia? Deadline White House continues after a quick break. Don't go anywhere.
Get the latest updates on this year's high-stakes election with MSNBC's How to Win 2024 newsletter. When you subscribe, you'll get expert analysis on key races sent straight to your inbox, including articles written by the host of the How to Win podcast, Jennifer Palmieri. Subscribe today at MSNBC.com/win.
It was the result of a process that was unlike anything I've ever witnessed in my FBI career. We know it to be a result that they rushed to get to before I was fired, essentially delivering the result that the president himself called for in his own Twitter messages about me and my planned retirement.
In all the instances, and we all watched them together in real time, there were so many, a petty, spiteful political retribution over the course of the Trump presidency, the sabotage, the viciousness toward Andrew McCabe and his retirement ranks all the way at the top. In fact, 6 months after that interview, Andrew McCabe, the former deputy director and one-time acting director of the FBI, sued the Bureau and the Department of Justice over wrongful termination, insisting his dismissal, depriving him of his pension mere hours before he was scheduled to retire, was in fact political retaliation. So now today, 2 years and one new president later, a resolution from the New York Times, who broke this story, quote, on Thursday, the department reversed Mr. McCabe's firing, settling a lawsuit he filed asserting that he was dismissed for political reasons. Under the settlement, Mr. McCabe, 53, will be able to officially retire, receive his pension and other benefits, and get about $200,000 in missed pension payments. In addition, the department agreed to expunge any mention of his firing from FBI personnel records. The agreement even made clear that he would receive the cufflinks given to senior executives and a plaque with his mounted FBI credentials and badge. joining us now. Nick Confessori, New York Times political and investigative reporter, and MSNBC political analyst, and Carol Lennig, Washington Post national reporter, MSNBC contributor, and co-author of the book, I Alone Can Fix It. Nick, something that was remarkable about Andrew McCabe's treatment was that it came after Jim Comey's firing, which was so personal and so harsh and so brutal. But somehow the maniacal obsession with firing McCabe the night before his retirement really did, as we said, sort of rank at the top of the political revenge stunts that Donald Trump managed to pull off. Mm-hmm.
That's right, Nicole. And look, it happened in the open. That was what was so, amazing about it at the time. The president tweeted, it's time to get rid of this guy before his 90 days come. And then it happened. It was all very obvious, and it sent a flare through the bureaucracy, through the FBI, that this guy will come after you if you cross him and don't bend to his will. I think the final irony for me always with Andy McCabe is that his alleged offense was to be involved in a leak of a story about Hillary Clinton's private email server, which, of course, was a story that Trump loved to talk about on the campaign trail in 2016. Somehow he was out there defending Hillary Clinton's honor by having this guy canned. It never added up. It was always very obvious. And the fact that it was obvious was the point.
Carol, I interviewed Andy McCabe. That's part of the interview. I want to ask you his answer to me about the toll this took on him and his family.
It's been an incredibly tough 2 years, and particularly this last year. I think, like all families that are challenged and have to step up to have to endure situations that they never asked for and didn't deserve, this experience has made us stronger. I have two children who I am so proud of. They've had to kind of live with the president taunting and bullying their father on Twitter, which is just a strange thing.
And mother,
absolutely right. And they have emerged as independent and strong and I'll say very politically aware teenagers. So, I'm just thankful to have their support and their love, and we'll get through it.
Carol, Andrew McCabe went through that. Colonel Vindman went through that. Pete Strzok went through that. Lisa Page went through that. Jim Comey went through that. We'd be here till 7:30 if we went through all the people whose lives were, if not ruined, dramatically altered by the heinous nature of Donald Trump's character as the country's commander-in-chief. And so whatever the McCabes get back today, no one gets back the years or the careers that Donald Trump costs them. Does that make sense?
You know, what's the most painful about watching this, Nicole, and hearing your interview with Andrew McCabe is thinking about the legion of career bureaucrats who experienced, if not as painful an experience as the McCabe family, something akin to it. Vindman is one, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman is one, but there are dozens, as you say. And in terms of the cost, think about the chill that this sent through the entire apparatus of the federal government. A president was hounding an FBI, at that time, acting director, whose one crime, apparently, was essentially that he believed there should be investigation of the sitting president. That's really the crime that Andy McCabe was involved in, as far as the president was concerned. But the chill this sends through the spine of the bureaucracy that's just doing its job, that's supposed to be protected from the political winds. And McCabe's experience is beyond the pale for another reason, Nicole. And that was, you may remember, the president wanted him investigated. He wanted him fired. Two line prosecutors with veteran careers withdrew from the investigation of McCabe in the U.S. Attorney's Office because they found it so disgusting. They found it so politically ridiculous. And my understanding from sources at that time was that they knew that no grand jury would convict him of the crimes that the president was ginning up. You'll also remember a Republican-appointed, Bush-appointed judge said that the way that Donald Trump was behaving towards Andrew McCabe was sending us on a path towards a banana republic. That was Reggie Walton, hardly a shrinking anti-government violet, one of the most pro-government judges, pro-prosecution judges you can find. I know him well. And to hear him say that that Donald Trump was, by pursuing McCabe in the way he did, putting us on a path to banana republic. I remember the chill I felt hearing that.
Well, I guess, you know, Carol, my follow-up for you would be this. I mean, it has emerged how totally devoted Donald Trump was to turning DOJ into an arm of his effort to overturn the vote count. So Andrew McCabe isn't just redeemed in this narrow decision. Donald Trump is revealed as never having any designs on the Department of Justice other than acting in his interests. And I wonder if that makes it all the more alarming that every Republican in Congress, other than Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, is all in on round two.
It's disturbing, and we've talked about it quite a bit, but the loop that Republicans have trapped themselves in, you know, spilling and enabling a series of lies of the president in order to stay in his good graces, now spills over into the next midterm election, a desire to keep their own seats, to win the House majority for the Republican Party. They now have to re-encourage people to believe a lie that they allowed to go unchecked. And they're caught in that web, and I don't know how they are going to get us, themselves, or the country out of it.
Carol Lenig, thank you for getting right to it and spending some time with us today. Nick is sticking around. When we come back, as the country grapples with shortages and supply chain issues, Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg has faced criticism from some on the far right for taking parental leave, really. Secretary Buttigieg will be our next guest after a quick break. Democrats in the Biden White House today giving their full-throated support to Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg amid bizarre attacks by the far right over parental leave, leave that he's taken to spend time with his husband, Chasten, and their beautiful twins, newborns, just a few weeks old. Biden administration is pointing to the attacks, some of which are frankly homophobic, in its fight for including paid parental leave for working families as part of the president's domestic agenda that's currently stuck in Congress. Joining us now is Secretary of the Department of Transportation and new dad, Pete Buttigieg. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on.
Well, welcome back. I want to just start here. I'm not going to play it because, frankly enough, people probably already saw it. But Tucker Carlson, I'll read some of what he said about you. Pete Buttigieg has been on leave from his job since August after adopting a child. Paternity leave, they call it. Fox News actually calls it the same thing and offers it to new dads. He went on to say something about breastfeeding, which I would say to Tucker Carlson, don't knock it till you try it. But what are these attacks about?
Well, look, in his case, I guess he just doesn't understand the concept of bottle feeding, let alone the concept of paternity leave. But what's really strange is that, this is from a side of the aisle that used to claim the mantle of being pro-family. What we have right now is an administration that's actually pro-family. And I'm blessed to be able to experience that, you know, as an employee, being able to have the flexibility to take care of our newborn children, which is, by the way, work. It's joyful work. It's wonderful work, but it's definitely work. And we as a society, I think, are starting to do a better job of recognizing that parenting is work, that caregiving is work, and supporting it as such, which is, of course, why the president has proposed paid family leave for all Americans, something most Americans already believe that we ought to do and something that most highly developed countries pretty much take for granted.
Well, I guess I want to push you on where you think this is coming from, because it's misogynistic, I guess, to think that dads shouldn't also be home. It feels homophobic to suggest that you were trying to figure out breastfeeding. I mean, it feels dirtier than that. How does this attack land for you and Chasten?
I mean, look, this attack is coming from a guy who has yet to explain his apparent approval for the assassination of Harvey Milk. So, you know, obviously we know that there's some dark places where some of these attitudes come from. But I also know that that doesn't speak for the country. I don't think that even speaks for most people on the other side of the aisle from the party that I belong to. This is largely a consensus issue, not just the support for families like mine to have a right to marry and right to be treated equally, but also that families in general, moms and dads, ought to be able to support their children, including with paid family.
Mr. Secretary, it's also an attack, it would appear, on your job performance. Tell me what you've come back to and talk about any progress being made on supply chain issues.
Yeah, well, let's be clear. I have been fortunate and privileged to be able to have this leave, but I've still been available 24/7 on issues that can't wait, issues that can't be delegated, and major decisions. And one of those issues that I've been involved with throughout is, of course, that of supply chains. You look at the effects of the pandemic, and you also look at the incredible return of demand, thanks to the president's leadership bringing back our economy. Long way to go, but look at the numbers right now. Record-breaking goods coming into this country. Retail sales off the charts. And what that means is demand is way up. Ports are handling more than they ever have. And it's coming into a supply chain that has needed a lot of attention, a lot of work, and a lot of support for a very long time. Now, for the big picture long term, this is exactly why we have spent the entire year talking about and working on the need for infrastructure investment. $17 billion for ports alone are part of the plan that the president has led on and that I've been proud to work on. But just to be clear, we've been doing a lot of tactical work, too. You know, earlier this week, I was with the president when he announced that the port of L.A. is going to 24/7 operations. The reason this is important is that LA and Long Beach, which are both making this change, just those two ports represent 40% of the container traffic coming into this country. A lot of Americans might have imagined that they already operated 24/7, but it hasn't worked that way in the past, mm-hmm. and it was not a simple thing to do. But after the gatherings and the convenings and the plans of action that we've been working on through the summer have been able to get to this point. Now, on its own, it's not enough to solve the problems that we face. We're talking about everything from issues with a shortage of truckers to things that are happening in terms of how inventory moves around the country. But an important step and just one example of the proactive work that we are doing to make sure we ease those bottlenecks and make it easier for goods to move around the country.
You are often one of the people that this administration taps to sort of communicate across the partisan divide. Not that it doesn't tap others, but I'm sure you know this already. This will be weaponized against the president and against the administration. Fear will be put into the hearts of every mom and dad, yourself included, as Christmas shopping season commences. What sorts of assurances can you give people about delivery times and about goods getting into the country and not having this linger and drag into the holiday shopping season?
What I can tell you is that these steps are going to make an impact. Look, let's be honest, the issues that we've been seeing, creating upward pressure on shipping prices and affecting deliveries, we've been seeing them for a while, and we're going to continue to see them for some time. But these steps are going to make a difference. Now, let's also remember that our supply chains are private sector, and rightly so. Right? The government does not and should not own and operate, you know, retail stores or freight trucks or freight rail lines, which is part of why this has been such a challenge to work on. But what we've done is brought together the people who do this work. We had a convening just earlier this week, securing commitments from the leaders of Walmart, of Target, of the Home Depot, as well as FedEx and UPS on steps that they can take to get goods moving more efficiently. And I do think those commitments, them stepping up, is going to make a big difference.
I want to come back to your leave and your time with your family. I know, at least for me, having a child changed how I saw my whole career in the past and in the future in politics. And I wonder if you had any epiphanies staring at those little innocent faces.
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously, I have a job with a lot of responsibility. I have a great career and one that's been so rewarding. But the moment that you hold your child in your arms for the first time, and you see how completely they depend on you, especially as newborns, you very quickly realize that no matter what your career may or may not include, the most important job you have is the job of parent, the job of father in my case. And you know, like so many working parents, I'm thinking about how best to meet that incredibly compelling responsibility while also the other responsibilities that I have in my day job. But it just changes everything. And you see the entire world in a new way. And it's a beautiful thing.
And it'll all become about the mute button. You know, those mornings you stay home to get a little bit more family time and try to hit mute before the president hears one of them cry. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, congratulations to you and Chasten. Thank you for spending some time with us in dealing with the attacks and the supply chain. We're grateful.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Democrats are on an all-out mission to make sure that Terry McAuliffe is the next governor of Virginia. When we come back, First Lady Dr. Jill Biden hits a campaign trail in a race that has major national implications. That story's next.
Hi, everyone. It's Katie Fang. Did you know my weekly show on MSNBC is now available as a podcast? With my decades of experience as a trial lawyer, you'll get an insider's perspective on all things legal. At a time when politics and the law are inextricably intertwined, my guests and I break down what's next and why it matters, both inside and outside the courtroom. Search for The Katie Fang Show wherever you're listening and follow.
We are moments away from seeing First Lady Dr. Jill Biden on the campaign trail in Virginia. She is set to speak at a rally for the Democratic nominee for governor there, Terry McAuliffe. The First Lady also campaigned in New Jersey earlier today for Governor Phil Murphy, marking the first time Dr. Biden has waded into the political waters since arriving at the White House in January. The First Lady's appearance is just one of the notable A-list Democrats that are set to campaign on behalf of the Democratic nominees for in the governor's races. President Barack Obama, Stacey Abrams, along with the president and vice president, are set to show up this month to campaign for Terry McAuliffe in that hotly contested race as Democrats attempt to stop Virginia from electing a Republican governor whose ascension could bring the kind of extreme right-wing laws and policies to Virginia that we've seen in states like Texas. Joining our conversation, Mara Gay, New York Times editorial board member and an MSNBC contributor, and Nick's still around. Mara, First Ladies have, most First Ladies, I would say, I'm thinking Michelle Obama, I'm thinking Laura Bush, real political appeal and power on the campaign trails. And there's always a point in a presidency when it's even more than their spouses. I don't know that President Biden is in that position yet, but Dr. Biden is certainly very popular.
I think that's right. You know, it's funny because I think what Dr. Biden brings that her husband doesn't is all of the kind of glam and feel good of the Obama-Biden coalition without all of the current frustrating politics that are vexing individual Democratic voters. So an individual Democratic donor might be apt to blame Joe Biden or be disappointed in him for some reason right now. You know, lots of reasons, but they're much less likely to do that with Dr. Biden. And so this is such a smart move. And it's kind of that soft political power that really can kind of turn out the vote. And that's what the Democrats are trying to do here. Ultimately, the polls are showing, right, that the projections are showing that the more people go out and vote, and they can vote early in Virginia as well, the more that favors the Democratic governor. So that's the goal here. It is an increasingly blue state, but they can't rely on that. You know, they're fighting apathy here. And that's really the name of the game. I mean, Virginia actually has more expansive voting laws than a lot of other southern states because Democrats have actually taken control of most political offices in the state. So they do actually have that advantage, but this is a ground game.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to read from the story. Mara summed it up and I think quoted the headline already, Nick. Virginia's fatigued electorate, former President Trump out of office, congressional Democrats in a bitter standoff, and Virginia Democrats having claimed every political prize. McAuliffe is straining to motivate liberal voters in his increasingly blue state. At the moment, one that's being watched closely by both parties for clues about the elections next year, he's bumping up against a fatigued electorate. Let me show you what Dr. Jill Biden will bring to the campaign trail in Virginia. This is her at the convention.
Across this country, educators, parents, first responders, Americans of all walks of life are putting their shoulders back, fighting for each other. We haven't given up. We just need leadership worthy of our nation, worthy of you, honest leadership to bring us back together, to recover from this pandemic and prepare for whatever else is next. The burdens we carry are heavy, and we need someone with strong shoulders. I know that if we entrust this nation to Joe, he will do for your family what he did for ours. Bring us together and make us whole. Carry us forward in our time of need. keep the promise of America for all of us.
Nick, it's amazing that, you know, that was at the convention, and we are still a country fighting with whatever this last phase, sort of the ebb at the end of the Delta wave. So much of that message is still relevant if that's the kind of note she sounds on the campaign trail.
Well, look, people in this country and in Virginia and else and are exhausted. People are tired. We've been in political warfare of the highest pitch for 4.5 years. And underneath this effort by Democrats to bring in all the big guns is some desperation and some fear. This is a surprisingly close race in Virginia from the polls. If McAuliffe loses, it will really rattle some assumptions people had about the trajectories of some states in the South, of Virginia, of the suburbs that were so key to delivering the presidency to Democrats in November. So this is a really big deal, and it's kind of a test bed for whether some of these debates we're seeing about diversity, and trans pronouns in schools. You see some of those debates cropping up in Loudoun County and Fairfax and in those suburbs south of D.C., whose turn to blue was a big part of the success for Democrats in the state. And so we're going to see if Republicans can peel some of those voters back, not that many, but change those margins a bit and maybe get a victory in Virginia.
We'll stay on it. We'll keep watching it with both of your help. Mara Gay, Nick Confessori, thank you so much for spending some time with us today. Quick break for us. We'll be right back. Our thanks to you for letting us into your homes during these extraordinary times. We're so grateful.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both The Saturday Show and The Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.